Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome to the inaugural episode of Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I am your host, Sarah Pavin, a two-time Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, and a longtime professional indoor player. I was an NCAA champion with the University of Nebraska and represented Canada internationally both indoor and on the beach for over 20 years. My co-host is none other than my husband, Adam Schultz, who's equally immersed in the volleyball world, albeit in a different way than me.
Hey everyone, my name is Adam. I played collegiately at McMaster University in Canada and then went on into the coaching world at the university level. I was a statistician for the Canadian national team, both indoor and on the beach, and as well for several professional teams around the world. For the last decade, I have been coaching on the beach, but at the international and AVP levels.
Adam and I love talking about volleyball, and we wanted to create this podcast to share our knowledge and opinions with people who are volleyball junkies like we are. On Volley Talk, we'll be bringing you weekly highlights from the world of NCAA and international volleyball, as well as sharing our insights on feature matches and sharing some hot takes. So without any further ado, let's get started. Pretty big week in NCAA volleyball. We're going to talk about some particularly spicy matches in a bit, but Utah had a really solid performance this week. They were unranked going into the week, but they took down number 17 TCU and number 18 Baylor 3-0, okay, in both matches. The outside hitter Cameron Gabadlo had a particularly strong weekend as she led the Utes in scoring in both matches.
It's interesting to see Utah. Like, sometimes you'll have an unranked team have a really good match and beat a ranked team, but here they beat two back-to-back 3-0. That doesn't happen by accident against two different teams. And I think the big thing for me looking at the stats was Utah hit 248 versus TCU's 167. And against Baylor, they were 391 against their team 202. So not only did they attack well, but they managed to keep the opposing team's efficiencies down pretty low. And that's hard to do against ranked teams.
Awesome game, but the whole team did it.
It's impressive to see. And I mean, the 248 is nothing to roll your eyes at either. I'm curious to see if they can keep those statistics going, you know, week after week. They're going to be really successful if they can.
Now, I didn't see the Utah-Baylor match, but like when I see numbers like that, I'm kind of like, either the Baylor defense was absolutely tragic or Utah was just unconscious.
Well, you have to think they were in system all match. So there must have been, either they passed really well or there was just no serving pressure.
Yeah, that's absolutely unbelievable. I feel like Utah's going to have to be ranked coming into this week with a performance like that, but we will see. Texas is also continuing their dominance in the SEC after losing three during the preseason. I mean, they do have a pretty tough schedule. They did drop one to Miami, but like probably not the start that they wanted for the season, but in the SEC play, they're now 5-0, and they handled Kentucky three straight as well.
I think the story there is Texas outblocked them 14-7, and they held Kentucky to 0.89 hitting percentage as a team. So you're outblocking them, serving really well, because you must have double blocks on their pin hitters all the time. That's an impressive stat line against the Kentucky team that was recently in the Final Four.
And it was a 7 versus 12 matchup. So, I know it's not like a 1-2 matchup where you're expecting like big things, 5-set barn burner, but like 7-12 matchup, that is...
You're talking about top 10 teams in the country. Like, that game should be a banger.
Like, the sets, there was only one set, I think, that Kentucky cracked 20 points.
Yeah, that's... I mean, that just shouldn't happen. For Texas to come in there and be that dominant... It's impressive.
Kentucky transfer Reagan Rutherford now plays for Texas. She had a great game.
You gotta love going back to your old barn and just lighting it up.
She was 10 for 16. She hit 438. So, I mean, we're not saying anything definitively here, But I mean,
a little extra motivation.
You never like to lose to your old team. So maybe a little extra motivation. Freshman Aiden Ames, who was the Nebraska commit, decommitted and decided to go to Texas instead. She went 6 for 10. So that was a good performance by the freshman for Texas.
Around the rest of the league, Florida lost a tough one to unranked South Carolina 3-0. And on the West Coast, Big Ten action saw a real mix-up. Oregon beat USC 3-0, UCLA over Washington 3-1, and then UCLA lost to USC in a tight intercity rival 3-2.
They're just trading wins and losses here. The new Big Ten additions, you know, they're just keeping things spicy. They're mixing it up. They're like, win-loss. They're just doing their own thing over on the West Coast here.
I'm going to be really curious to see them travel and play some of the standard Big Ten teams.
Well, I mean, UCLA started Big Ten play against Nebraska, lost to them in 4 in Lincoln. I mean, it's going to be an adjustment. The Pac-10 was no slouch, but it also was not the Big Ten. I mean, the Big Ten is for sure the standard, the gold standard as far as NCAA volleyball is concerned. So, I mean, it is going to be an adjustment, but we'll see how it plays out.
And just out of curiosity, how much do you think the travel plays into their ability to perform or them not being used to it? Because they're traveling like a pro team at this point.
I think it's actually insane. I am very opinionated about this. I understand that it is great for the league. Great. We can probably dive into this in another day. But like, do these girls go to school anymore? That's what I want to know. Like, how are they managing this? And I guarantee, like, not all of these teams fly private. There are some teams that definitely do, but a lot of these schools are still flying commercial. So like, what happened to an education? We will dive into this deeper on another episode because, like, this is something I'm very passionate about. But yeah, I digress. To finish off our weekly roundup, Louisville squeaked out a 5-set win over Florida State. But the games everybody's been talking about, our feature matches for the week are Pitt versus SMU and Nebraska versus Purdue. It was an interesting week with Pitt and SMU. They played each other basically back to back. So in Pittsburgh, Pitt won 3-0 on Wednesday night, and then they turned around and played each other again on Saturday. And I think the moment the NCAA was waiting for was Pitt losing in 5. It was wild.
After having only dropped one set all season.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I honestly don't think this is a bad thing for Pitt. I think having an undefeated season where you're not really pushed is tough to maintain all season long. I'm guessing this is going to be a little bit of a tune-up. Go back, watch some video, figure out what you did wrong. Definitely some nerves and being unsure of how to push back when teams have you on the ropes. And I think that, you know, we'll get into this, but my thoughts on their setter and how she progressed throughout the match, I think was a big one for me.
I honestly don't hate that they lost. Speaking from personal experience, playing at Nebraska the years that I was there, we were ranked like number one, number two-ish around there in the country like every season. And when you're at the top, people are just gunning for you. So it is very hard to stay there. But it's really hard to maintain that consistency for 4 months. You know what I'm saying? So I don't hate that they lost. Every year that I played at Nebraska, the years that we did best, we had just like a head-scratching loss. And not to say that SMU is a head-scratcher. Like, they were ranked 15 this week. They are a good team for sure. But I think that this can give them renewed motivation, really bring them down to earth to be like, okay, we're not invincible here. We have some things that we need to work on. And I think it'll make them, or I hope it'll make them come back stronger.
So this was the first time that I had watched SMU play. And a couple of things that I was impressed with. I thought their left side, Shimei, had a really great match. She had 20 kills and hit 289. And I thought she was a real driving force for that team, along with middle blocker Okamore. Whenever they were together in the front row, they made life really difficult for Pitt. They scored a bunch of block points and just seemed to build momentum for their team when they were on the floor. I thought their coach made some great adjustments later in the match, which we can talk about after. But I was also really impressed with Foster's serving. She put them in a lot of trouble with her hybrid serve.
Okay. You literally mentioned the three players from SMU that I wanted to talk about. So I am glad that we're on the same page. You know, I like when we disagree because then things get extra spicy and I love debating these things with you. But, you know, we'll start out smooth for episode one and we can agree on this. I think those three players, Foster, the thing I liked most about her was her serve. Loved the hybrid. She put Pitt in a lot of serve receive trouble. And I love how aggressive it is. It's definitely a weapon. Okamor and Shimei were the stars for me. But I also do think that Purdue, not the school, the player, everybody, she deserves some props as well. She has seen like seriously limited action this season, but she came in and she scored some big points when she needed to, and she really made a difference down the stretch for SMU. So I just wanted to give her a shout out. But Okamor and Shimei, like, blocking clinic by Okamor.
Especially late in the match.
It was wild.
So here's a question for you. How much of an effect do you think SMU being mostly graduate students plays in their ability to win these tight matches?
Okay, thank you for saying that, because I definitely think that this is worth mentioning. Every single starter on SMU is a graduate student.
There's something to be said for having that much experience.
I don't want to take away from them. Like, obviously, this is the team that they have on the floor. This is the team that they've been training, whatever. But like, seven graduate students, like, there's not, I'm curious to see if this program has any type of longevity, because they collected so many players from the transfer portal and all of them are going to be gone next year. But conversely, when we started watching the match, I was like, I recognize all these players from Pitt.
Yep.
And there are a couple grad students there, you know, but they stayed. They did their undergrad at Pitt. They stayed at Pitt. I have so much respect for that. I believe in where you choose to go unless something is crazy, like you see it through. I am old school. I am a purist in that way. So I loved seeing Pitt's lineup look virtually the same as it was last season. I do want to say Torrey Stafford for me was the standout player for Pitt.
Agreed.
I also love their attitude. I love a stuff and stare. Like, when you get that block, make them feel it. And I definitely was like giggling seeing Stafford and Jones do that a few times when they were blocking. But yes, I think going back to your question, I think the grad student aspect needed to be said. It needed to be said. I also, you liked Fairbanks for approximately 50% of the match, and then you were like, absolutely not.
Well, so watching her set the first three sets, I thought she did an incredible job of moving the ball around, of balancing the offense, of getting her hitters, you know, one-on-ones, one-on-one-and-a-halves, and just making SMU middles work to close blocks. And I thought she did a fantastic job. However,
and then
moving into the fourth and fifth set, I think she set the middles maybe three times. Don't quote me on that. I don't have the stats in front of me, but it wasn't a lot. And you could see Okamor just looking at her and knowing exactly where she was going to put the ball. And they made life for Babcock miserable in those fourth and fifth sets. And not only did they know where it was going, Fairbanks sets were a little all over the map. Some of them were inside, some of them were flaring off the net. And I mean, Babcock is a player of the year, I believe.
Player of the year candidate. She's a sophomore.
You know, you got to find a way to score as your top hitter on the team. But Fairbanks definitely didn't put her in a good position late in the match. And I'm curious if that was only because of the passing, or if, again, like I said before, they're being applied with some pressure from SMU, and she's like, I'm just going to set our best hitter. And she kind of lost confidence in her offense to get the job done. I'll be curious to see how she bounces back after this.
It was honestly hard to watch. It was, you could tell that she was just so desperate for Stafford and Babcock to put the ball away. And it was so hard to watch because you're like, set the middle. And it's just like, okay, you have the experience. You've played in a couple Final Fours. Like, how is this happening? I completely agree with what you're saying about the Babcock situation. She just like fell off a cliff at the end of set four and just could not find herself again. If you are a National Player of the Year candidate, you need to find ways to score. And I'm not saying like, we're not talking small errors here. We're talking absolutely getting stuff blocked multiple times in a row or hitting it out like into the bleachers. These things weren't even close. So I was really disappointed to see that response. I don't disagree with you. The balls that Fairbanks was putting up for her were tough. She was getting killed inside. When she was hitting from the back row, those balls were being led way too far for her. But still, the best players find a way. And she did not. I understand you're not going to play great every game. Every player has matches that they don't play amazing. Been there. I get it. I understand. But this looked particularly bad. And honestly, Tori Stafford kind of was the only one that held it together there for Pitt.
Well, you mentioned that. And so I thought something that was really interesting, I had to give props to the SMU coach. So in the fourth set, they had Okamura lined up on Babcock to mm-hmm. try and slow her down. And side note, I thought Shimei did a fantastic job of adjusting her block lineup when the set started going inconsistent. And they made her life miserable. And Stafford was the only one scoring. And then in the fifth set, their coach takes a bit of a flyer and lines Babcock up on Stafford to make her life miserable, assuming or hoping that Babcock wasn't going to find her rhythm and be able to score. And they made life miserable for Stafford in that fifth set. And I thought that was a really ballsy move by the coach that paid off. And when you're playing the number one team in the country, sometimes you got to take those gambles. And her players delivered on that strategy, and I thought that was really cool.
I 100% agree. That was a ballsy tactical decision, but she rolled those dice, and baby, it worked. I mean, Babcock did not recover after set four, but I think the thing that the tactical shift that really set everything in motion for the demise of Pitt in that match was in the middle of set four. We saw some huge momentum shifts early, like real bad. Both ways.
Yep.
And then at 15-15, the libero for SMU went back to serve. Pitt was in rotation five. So Stafford was passing on the left, the middle. Kelly was in the on the left side as well. So they were stacked. And there were two incredibly executed short serves to zone four. The middle had to take them, but Stafford kind of got held up because she was in her approach line. And SMU just sent two blockers right over to Babcock and got two massive stuff blocks. And that kind of wrote the story there for the rest of the match. So I thought that kind of set the tone and was an amazing tactical shift. But then the lineup switch in set five kind of sealed the deal. Honestly, SMU played steady when it counted. They did not look great for a lot of the match, but part of me says Pitt lost.
Oh, interesting. I mean, I think if Fairbanks continues to put up consistent hittable balls, yeah, I mean, a lot of things probably would have had to go their way. It seems like they had a couple players who normally are solid, have not great last two sets, and they're the number one team. I mean, they can probably beat most teams. That's fair.
Overall, entertaining match to watch, but I leave that match with the big question of, who is going to draw SMU come tournament time?
They're going to ruin somebody's bracket.
100%. You know that those top seeds are just like crossing their fingers that SMU is not in their regional because they upset Nebraska early this season. Then they upset Pitt. Like, they are capable of disrupting things for teams. Do I think that they have what it takes to be consistently a top four program right now? No, absolutely not. But they have shown that they can show up when it matters. So
I want to see them against two or three more ranked teams and put that same performance on the floor. They played well, not going to take anything away from them, but you got to do it again. And then you got to do it one more time. That's what the best teams do.
Our second feature match this week was Nebraska versus Purdue.
Of course, it had to be Nebraska. We couldn't start this podcast and not watch a Nebraska match.
Go Big Red. No, I'm just kidding. I will, you know what? I will probably end up being more critical of Nebraska than other teams. So it's like when you're coaching your own kid. Not that I have kids, but I have heard and from experience.
Well, and honestly, you're more critical of me than anybody else. So.
So I've heard that you're more critical of your own kid when you're a coach. So why would this be any different? We have seen Purdue play several times this year.
Oof.
We saw them play Penn State. They were absolutely terrible.
I didn't think they were going to win a single match after watching that game.
That was hard to watch. Then we saw them pick it up against Minnesota. So they've clearly, you know, righted the ship, so to say. But this was a tight one. 3-2 victory for Nebraska in Lincoln. And we went overtime in set five.
It was a lot of fun to watch. It was really back and forth. And it left me with a lot of questions.
Oh, me too. I need to start that before I get into the critiques. I need to give a shout out to Andy Jackson. I am so impressed with this girl. She started the match going 11 for 12. 11 for 12. That is insane. She had a little bit of a dip partway through set three and into set four, but she righted herself again. But aside from the numbers, she makes life so easy for her outside hitters because teams respect her. They have to respect her.
I loved how much work she puts in. She's running slides. She's putting up blocks. She's available in almost every transition set, running all over the place. That girl puts in work, and it was great to see. She was my favorite player to watch in that 100%. Match.
And she's got a little toot on her, too.
Which you love.
I love it. Give me a little attitude. Give me a little fire, a little sass.
So before we get into the other takes, I had a question or a thought watching that Nebraska game in that I don't know that they have anybody with killer instinct. And I watched Jackson play and I thought, there's their player who knows how to win, who's going to push, who wants the ball at the end of the match and who will score points for you. But you need one other player other than a middle to also be that way. Beeson's not bad. She's steady and she's really skilled. But you don't see that fire from her. And I'm curious if they're going to be able to step up when they're playing top teams.
It's interesting you say that about Beeson because I do think that she could be that player for them. So this kind of leads into one of my hot takes and critiques of the Nebraska team right now is I think she's a little bit unsure of what her role is. Sometimes, you know, she'll serve and then get taken out. Sometimes she won't even get to serve and then we'll get thrown in if a rotation can't score. Sometimes she'll get to stay in the back. Like I don't think she knows what she is going to be doing, but I think that she needs to play six rotations.
Well, it almost seemed like they didn't want to leave her in the back row, but their left sides in two of those rotations couldn't score. Like they couldn't get out of that rotation, so they had to put her in to run the pipe.
Yeah, I think if she's given the opportunity to just be a true right side and just bang on balls for six rotations, be an outlet when things are going sideways, I think you will start to see a little more of that swagger and that attitude from her, because you did see a bit of it last season when she was playing six rotations, but now she's kind of back and forth in the back row, and I personally think that's a mistake, especially because when she is serving, you've got Krause, Alec, and the setter, Bergen Riley, in the front row. That is, in my opinion, a liability.
There's no offense there. I don't think I saw Rebecca hit a clean ball all match. No, that's not true. She hit one good snap back to position one, and the rest of them were paintbrushes and kind of miss hits. And she was relatively effective, but you're not blocking those balls. So you can just vacate and hang out on the left side. And their setter doesn't get that involved in the offense most of the time. It's a tough rotation. And Beeson's going to need to be that player for them to be successful.
I 100% agree. I don't think Lindsey Crousey is terminal enough to counteract Rebecca Alex's lack of production offensively. You can just see Purdue does not respect her at all. It was like night and day when Alec was in the front row versus Jackson. Alec, they don't even care because she's not making contact with the ball. It's just like, okay, let's just try to react to it. Like, it's a paintbrush. Jackson, however, anytime there was a possibility that she could get the ball, the outsides were one-on-one.
Yeah.
Anytime. And so I am so confused as to Nebraska's choice of lineup, because you have your lowest producing middle offensively in the front row with Lindsey Crousey, who, I'm sorry, is not the most terminal outside. So I don't know. My hot take is they need to switch their rotation and Merritt Beeson needs to stay in the back row to give them a chance, because they, Purdue, when they were down, they made their comebacks and they made their runs in that rotation when Berg and Riley was in rotation position four.
Yeah.
I did think it was a good call to bring in Taylor Landfair, though, because at one point, Crousey was 2 kills, 2 errors, and 14 swings. And then luckily, she had a great server go back and she was able to pad her stat line by hitting some overpasses. But like, you can't score points because your servers did a great job.
Well, I think Landfair didn't start well, but she was able to kind of find a rhythm as the match went on and score. And that was one of the reasons why I think they pulled this off in 5 sets.
She did make some big swings in the 5th set for sure.
Speaking of the 5th set, a couple thoughts. One is, for Purdue, I understand you had to serve tough because Nebraska is such a great ball control team, but they gave up 4 service errors on the first 7 Nebraska points. You, when the match is in the 5th set, you've got to do a better job at finding that balance. If you're the 3rd server to go back there and miss, you've got to be thinking, I gotta stir strategically. I'm gonna take away an option with a location serve versus just trying to bomb out of the ball. They didn't put Nebraska under any pressure at the beginning of that 5th set. And then on top of that, they get a free ball at 10-8 or 10-7 off a great serve. And they did nothing with it. They gave a free ball back. Are you kidding me? You need to ram that ball down their throats if you get a free ball in the 5th set in double digits. We're talking 11-8 instead of 10-9 going into the end of that set, which you lose by 2 points at the end. Somebody is doing towel runs or something for that play, because you essentially lost the game there, in my opinion.
That was ridiculous. And I am a Nebraska fan, okay? I love Nebraska, but even I was screaming at the TV when Purdue returned a free ball with a free ball. I was like, what? How does this happen? Literally, that, all things being said, if you like taking everything away, if you want to find one play that messed things up for Purdue this match, it was that one.
Yep.
Especially in a 5th set to go up 3 points instead of 1. Give me a break. I 100% agree with you on the serving issues, though. They missed 19 serves in that match. You almost handed Nebraska an entire full set missing serves. And I'm sorry, but it's not like you guys were like crushing them.
Well, they didn't get very many aces. But the thing for me is, you need to serve tactically. So if Jackson's in the front row and you're not getting stops anyway, go back to the baseline and rip it. You miss. They're siding out at 700. In those 3 rotations. But when she's not in the front row and you've got Raven blocking, who did a fantastic job in that match, you've got to put the ball in. You've got to score your points there. And it just seemed they had the, we're going to serve aggressive no matter what mentality, which again, I love that for a team and you need to find it. But you also need to understand where you are, where your strengths are, and when you're going to take those risks. And that was something I didn't think they did very well.
That it was really hard to watch. And like I said, we've seen them play a few times this season, and I have noted it's been a pattern. Their serving has been absolutely atrocious in every match we've watched. So they need to figure it out, because they're clearly good. They're good enough. They're pushing good teams, but like, they need to get it together.
Shout out to Eva Hudson and Chloe Chicane for having great matches in 100%. That match. Offensively, they held the team together. They both hit really well. Hudson, 349. Chicane, 327. Am I pronouncing that right?
Chicoine. But I think everybody knows. People know who you mean.
And the one thing I will say for Purdue, I hope they take some time this week and work on it. Raven blocked incredibly well.
Yes.
But she could not find a rhythm with her setter. She's so athletic. She jumps so well. They need to find her, and they need her to be an offensive threat as well as a defensive stalwart, because she did a great job at that.
Good word.
So hopefully she can find that, because she could be a dominant player for them.
Yeah, I 100% agree. The left sides for Purdue definitely carried the weight for the team. And Raven Colvin, I mean, her blocking was incredible. It was a fun match to watch. I think you can tell listening to us, a lot of frustration and a lot of questions for both sides. So
I'll be curious to see both of those teams play a few more ranked opponents, which is coming up. I mean, that conference is so stacked. So we're going to see some more games, and we're going to see who steps up and what other patterns continue from those two.
So in watching NCAA volleyball this season, there is a pattern that I've noticed, and it's been bothering me. And I just need to talk about it.
For all of you, just to be aware, we're entering Sarah's hot takes portion of the show.
I don't even know if it's a hot take, because it's like, can you disagree with this? Okay, maybe you can.
Every team is doing it. They're all going to disagree with you.
Hear me out. Okay. So something I've noticed, obviously offenses have gotten very fast. And, you know, for a right side blocker who has to help in the middle and then get outside, it's tough. When the ball is coming that fast to the hitter, it is hard to cover everything. And so I've noticed that a lot of right side blockers have been leaving a lot of line when the hitter's hitting. Totally fine. I get it. The part I don't get is the diggers in zone one have been coming up for tips so frequently and getting absolutely blasted. It's like, I don't know if this is a game plan decision. I don't know if it's just a lack of awareness thing, but it's like, if the offense is being run that fast and you know that the blocker is not going to get the line, you need to be back digging the line. Like, are you so preoccupied with the tip that like that is happening? If the tip is that big of an issue, you don't see that many hitters coming up and hitting the ball angle in front of the 10-foot line, have the off blocker just worry about the tip or read and react. But why is everybody coming under for tips when they should be digging the line?
Well, two thoughts. One, I don't know if you saw it, but Landfair was digging tips in the front row and still did not get it. In fact, I believe the libero got a better hand on a few of those tips coming from the back corner of the court than Landfair. So some of our left sides are maybe not as engaged in defense as they should be. So that's one. And the second one is, I'm wondering if they're looking at the consistency of the setters and saying, you're not getting the ball all the way out to the pin when you're running that fast. So on the three or four balls where you do and they annihilate the line, we're going to give you those ones. But we're assuming we're going to get a block touch, or you're not going to be able to hit that shot for, you know, 90% of the hitter-setter combos. Now, you played internationally where the setters deliver that ball more consistently. Maybe that's the disconnect, but those are the only two things that I can think of, because I agree with you on principle.
Well, and I mean, I was a hitter who was like, I'm going to hit angle and then sharper angle and then sharper angle. But even for me, it's like, if I saw that much line available, I'm going to hit it.
You also played with some incredible setters.
Shout out to the setters I played with. You really were great. Yeah. So that it's been happening with a variety of teams I've been watching play, with a variety of players on those teams. And it's just like, how is this happening? So that is my big concern for the week, and something that has just been like frustrating me.
I don't know that I have a hot take for this week, but something that I've noticed that I really am glad to see is the amount of back row attacks that we're starting to see in the NCAA. I remember watching, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and they were all defensive players in the back row. And there's nothing wrong with that. But there was just no offense coming out of the back row. And now we're starting to see Babcock's hitting out of the back row. We're starting Harper Murray hitting out of the back row.
Every team has someone coming out of the back row now.
And not only that, they're running it well. They're leading those hitters into the front row. You're starting to see some no blocks coming out of the middle on those ones. And it's really good. And coming from more of the international game versus the college game, where that's, you know, a staple of the offense, it's really good to see. And I think bodes well for the future of USA volleyball, because these athletes are part of the offense in the back row and playing those six rotations.
I mean, as somebody who made a career hitting back row, arguably I was better hitting from the back row than the front. I love to see it. I love that they are leading these hitters. You're seeing these girls land on the center line of the court. That is how it needs to be run, ladies and gentlemen. I love it. And it has really broken my heart in recent years to see it used more as an emergency type of play, or a get out of trouble play, than an integrated part of the offense. So I am all about that. And as we continue here, you will for sure notice that Adam will probably always have the positive takes and I will be critical. Okay, so
we'll see.
Get ready for that. Yeah, those were our little tidbits that we wanted to talk about, but this week coming up has got some big matches that I'm excited to see.
So on Friday, I'm really looking forward to the Oregon and Wisconsin match. I think that you're going to have two big teams going at it. I don't even know what my prediction for that match will be.
Well, this past week, I think they were 9-11 in the ranking. And I'm pretty sure they're in Wisconsin. Don't quote me on that. I could be wrong. If they're in Wisconsin, I'm going to say Wisconsin in four.
I can't make a prediction on that match. It's too close. And then on Sunday, I'm looking forward to the Minnesota-Penn State match.
Penn State, number three. I think Penn State will win. I'm going to say also in four.
I think that one's going to go to five.
Ooh, love a five-setter. Stanford also has a big week coming up. On Wednesday, they're in Dallas taking on SMU, and on Sunday, they've got Pitt. So it is a heavy week for Stanford.
So I think the Stanford-Pitt game is going to be a fantastic match, just in general. I'm actually really curious to see SMU take on Stanford. I want to see the same thing. I want to see them push those ranked teams. I want to see the product that they put on the court this past week continue for another week, not just a blip of, hey, we played really great volleyball this weekend.
Yeah, I don't want to see them satisfied, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, lots of good games coming up. We are really excited. That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something happening in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix with us. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will be back next week.
See you guys later.